guardian.co.uk.
This podcast is sponsored by audible.co.uk, the number one online destination for digital audiobooks.
The Guardian Poetry Podcast.
I'm John Burnside, and I've chosen The Retrieval System by Maxine Cumin to read. It begins with my dog, now dead, who all his long life carried about in his head the brown eyes of my father, keen, loving, accepting, sorrowful, whatever. They were Daddy's eyes all right, handed on, except for their phosphorescent gleam tunnelling the night, which I have to concede was a separate gift. Uncannily, when I'm alone, these features come up to link my lost people with the patient domestic beasts of my life. For example, the weathered goat who runs free in pasture and stable with his flecked agate eyes and his minus sign pupils bleats in the tiny voice of my former piano teacher, whose bones beat time in my dreams and whose terrible breath soured country gardens, humoresque and unplayable Bach. My elderly aunts, wearing the heads of willful, intelligent ponies, stand at the fence, begging apples. The sister who died at 3 has my cat's faint chin, my cat's inscrutable squint, and cried, cat-like, in pain. I remember the funeral. The Lord is my shepherd, we said. I don't want to brood. Fact, it is people who fade. His animals that retrieve them. A boy I loved once keeps coming back as my yearling colt, cocksure at the gallop, racing his shadow for the hell of it. He runs merely to be. A boy who was lost in the war 30 years ago and buried at sea. Here it's 40 degrees and raining. The weatherman, who looks like my resident owl, the one who goes out and in by the open haymow, appears on a TV screen. With his heart-shaped face, he is also my late dentist's double, donished, bifocaled, kind. Going little grey, advising this wisdom tooth will have to come out someday, meanwhile filling it as a favour, another save. It outlasted him. The forecast is nothing but trouble. It will snow fiercely enough to fill all these open graves. I like this particular poem because of the way it uses rhythm and rhyme. I like the looseness of it. There's a certain degree of looseness. It's not as fixed as perhaps someone who, from the generation before, say, Marianne Moore, who is very experimental with rhythm and with rhyme, but stands a form, but does it in quite a fixed way quite often. Maxine Cumin's got that lovely kind of loose-limbed, flowing quality about her work, which is musical, but it's musical more in the way of, say, something like jazz is. So the use of internal rhyme, for example, is beautifully done. I mean, for example, where she says, my elderly aunts stand at the fence. You know, those two internal rhymes are beautiful and kind of witty as well. And there are other things about it, like... The retrieval system. It's about, you know, retrieving memories, retrieving lost things. But the first thing it says, it begins with my dog, and of course you immediately think retriever. It's just little jokey things like that. But perhaps more kind of technically interesting is, since this is a poem about doubles, it's about something looking like something else and evoking something else, it's interesting that if you go through the poem, there's the obvious idea, the idea of the double, is foreshadowed all the way through a long sequence of rhymes, starting with sorrowful in the first stanza, then in the second, people, example, stable, pupils. And in the next stanza, there's willful, apples. And then so it goes on, and you're thinking, well, double's coming, and then only in the last stanza, when you think that momentum has actually been dropped and been left behind, in the last stanza, you get it attached to the dentist, so you get my late dentist's double. So the what you've been anticipating, and it's the kind of key idea of the poem, is attached to a rather kind of pathetic or trivial image of a dentist, you know, kind of graying dentist bending over you. But it's beautifully done. But that also tells you that, in fact, of course, the poem isn't just about that idea of doubling, that one thing suggests another. The way the speaker of this poem exists in the poem, you see her right at the centre of a network of connections, her personal, her own network of connections, just as you or I have a network of connections that's specific to us. She's there in the centre of this world. And that's emphasised by the use of my and I a lot in the poem. The word my appears much more than it needs to. So it's saying, this is my experience of the world. But she's got this network going out into the human world and into the animal world. And so it isn't just about things appearing similar from those two worlds, as it were. It's really about the interconnectedness through objects, as it were, in the world. Those connections are achieved by being networked through something. And that's philosophically very, very interesting. So she's playing around with an idea of doubleness and similarity, but in fact, by extending that and making the double rhyme come right at the end of the poem, she makes you see that it's really about something else. I began being interested in poetry almost reluctantly because I grew up as a working-class Catholic child in England. And for us, poetry was Rupert Brooke saying, "If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of foreign field, it is forever England," etc. And it wasn't really particularly appealing to me to have this kind of jingo. Well, it wasn't jingoistic, it was Rupert Brooke. But I remember that when I first read an American poem, and it may well have been Marianne Moore's Steeplejack, and thinking, wow, this is something completely different. And the way in which the music of American poetry, it's like when you first hear real jazz as opposed to what British people think of as trad jazz, where you hear something that's loose and inventive and playful and very serious and all of those things. It's like when you first hear, say, bebop or cool, you realise that the world is is infinite in its possibilities. For me, British poetry at the time, certainly growing up, it seemed very rigid to me. There were poets that I loved, but it seemed that they couldn't go outside a certain frame. And American poets, this is far too general, but American poets seem to be much more ready to just jump out of the frame and see what happened. And they would fall flat on their face. I mean, Allen Ginsberg falls flat on his face many times, but then he does things like, you know, amazing things like, you know, the poem to America, for example. Also, American poets, I think, are much more interested in process. They let the process kind of exist in the poem. They play around with things. They say, well, what if I did this? No, I'm going to go and do this now. But they just leave that in the poem. They leave that on the page, as it were. And I love the way that American poets do that, like Jory Graham in different ways, Mark Doty, who does it in a very different way, but both doing it's that same thing of just exploring what the possibilities of thought are within the poem. I think the other thing about Maxine Cohen, I think, I looked at a lot of her work and thought, oh, I can detect influences here. And they're definitely there, but I'm working in academy, I often find we spend too much time thinking about influence, because the first thing a student asks you is, was so-and-so influenced by so-and-so? And I think the best examples of influence are where the influence is very light. You know, we've seen the disastrous effects of, as it were, heavy influence. A lot of confessional poets, for example. Marianne Moore has a wonderful moment in a letter. Allen Ginsberg sent some poems and wrote a letter explaining that he was a young poet and he wanted to have her advice. And she was editor of The Dial at the time. And she said, she obviously found some interest in the work. I think he was about 17 or something at the time. He said, at this point, your protagonist goes to the bathroom. Unfortunately, we go with him. And she was just trying to teach him a little bit about, you know, you draw the line somewhere. And of course, that was during that kind of period when everything just began to hang out, the kind of Delmore Schwartzy kind of world of... And she just wanted to have a little bit more fastidiousness in the art. When I think about influence and I think about my own work, I think I have to confess to being influenced by American poets. But again, hopefully that it's a light influence. I think as much as, say, being influenced by Maxine Kuhnman or Marianne Moore or whoever, I would be just as influenced in that sense by Miles Davis, actually, or Charlie Parker. Or it's the freedom to make music without being too rigid in the form. There's a wonderful possible dialogue between British and American poetry right now, which isn't happening. I've been trying to get people to engage in it. And it seems that on this side of the water, at least, there's a lot of resistance talking to American poets. The richest thing that's happened in my life is actually meeting some of the poets that I most like to read and discussing their work with them and what poetry is about. And the thing that comes over most is that sense of complete respect for form in America. British people tend to say, oh, they're not interested in form. They're just doing form differently. What I find most rewarding is that sense of form has so much more possibility in American poetry. And, of course, there are very formal poets in America, and there have been all the way through the 20th century. And there has to be we have to avoid that kind of simplistic thing of Americans experimental, British is too formal. But there is this kind of sense of form that still is there, but informs a kind of freedom, which then allows one to make different kind of music.
Visit audible.co.uk/guardianaudio to choose from a selection of over 60,000 titles. With Audible, you can make more time for books by downloading and listening to them wherever you are, whatever you're doing.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.